Hello, everyone, and welcome to Here's to Your Health with Dr. Burns. I am Dr. Burns, and I have a special guest with me, Kevin Spellman, Mr. PhD himself. He is a fantastic herbalist, international researcher, clinician, you name it, adjunct faculty. He's even like had his own clinic. He has worked very hard for his doctorate and is currently, you know, it's like doing research and out. It looks like doing a little R&R. So, how are you doing, Dr. Spellman?
Hello, Dr. Burns. I'm doing well. How are you?
I'm doing very well. So now I know that we are having you on our show today to basically talk about wellness. And one of the things that I know that you do is you are like one of the top rated researchers with herbal medicine. And I was wondering if you could tell us, you know, right now there is, it's splashed all over the news that there's more strains of bacteria that's becoming resistant to antibiotics, and that even like Zithromax, which is also known as the Z-Pak, can also cause heart failure. So can you give us some insight on why do you think that is, why all of a sudden we're getting like these resistant bacteria, and what herbal, because I've never heard of herbal medicine, you know, bacteria being resistant to herbal medicine, and what the latest research is showing with that.
Sure. Well, first and foremost, I think it's completely predictable that a biological organism is going to develop resistance to one chemical. If you look at this from an evolutionary perspective, organisms have never had to deal with just one chemical at a time, and therefore, in terms of a complexity model, it's actually very simple for an organism to figure out a way or to select a way around a single chemical. And that's what we do in the medical model, generally speaking, although that is starting to change. But generally speaking, for example, when we're using antibiotics, we use one chemical at a time. Now, when we do that, what we do is we make it easy for an organism to develop resistance. Now, your comment about, you know, not developing resistance to an herbal medicine, I think many people in the science field would actually have a hard time with that. However, I understand what you're saying, and that is that what we're doing with an herbal medicine is introducing a multitude of chemicals all at once to an organism, and therefore it is a more complex approach, thus making it more difficult to develop resistance around one chemical as opposed to a pharmaceutical versus many chemicals. So it kind of brings in the idea of synergy. And if you look at the idea of multiple chemicals acting on a, converging actually on a biochemical pathway, what you'll find is that you can get a more efficacious results and potentially, according to some of the research, a safer result from using smaller doses of multiple chemicals as opposed to a larger dose of one chemical.
Okay. And so, and then with that one, how long then would you say that, you know, doing a multiple chemical in like a longer dose is better than, say, like doing one chemical in a shorter dose?
Well, great question. And let's take a real world example. Let's take the example of malaria. So the current drug used to treat malaria is artemisinin or derivatives of artemisinin. And this is, it's been on the market now, I guess, for at least a decade, maybe a bit more, and is relatively newly introduced into Africa and Southeast Asia. Now, Southeast Asia, in terms of malaria, has a particular reputation for being a place where resistance to malarial drugs develops rather quickly. And so, indeed, what we have found is that there's already this fairly new drug on the market, and there is nothing else close in terms of a new drug for malaria being developed at this point. They're working on it, but there's nothing close. So this new drug on the market has already, in Southeast Asia, there's already been resistance developed to it. So that's this artemisinin. Now, artemisinin comes from a plant called Artemisia annua, also known as Sweet Annie, and you'll be familiar with Dr. Burns.
Mm-hmm.
And Interestingly, if you look at how many compounds in Sweet Annie are actually effective against Plasmodium or this organism, this protozoa that causes malaria, you'll find that there are at least seven compounds that are directly active against Plasmodium. And then you'll find that there's at least two to four compounds that will, if you will, potentiate or synergize the active compounds. So making this real world, there's a group called ANIMED, Action for Natural Medicine. They're out of Germany. And what they have done is they have gone into rural Africa and rural South America where malaria is a huge problem. And by the way, malaria is the biggest killer of humans on the planet. Up to 3 million people a year are affected by malaria. Most of the people dying from malaria are kids under five. And so it really is a huge, huge issue. So what ANIMED has done is they've taken seeds of Sweet Annie and they've taken it to these rural areas in Africa and these rural areas in South America. And they've taught the locals how to cultivate and grow this particular plant that is the source of artemisinin. Now, at first thought, most pharmacologists and most medical doctors are going to think, oh my God, they're going to cause resistance. Because in fact, there is not that much, less than 1% of artemisinin in Sweet Annie. And thus, the idea is that there's not enough dose to actually kill the Plasmodium. And therefore, there's going to be resistance that's developed. But instead, what's happened is, and if you look at these people's data, what you'll find is that these people are actually saving lives by teaching people to cultivate and grow and then on to making a tea and how to treat malaria with a simple plant tea. Not only is that kind of cool because, number one, they're saving lives, and number two, though, if you look at the dose of the cost of a dose of artemisinin in Africa, it's about $3 for one dose. Now think about that, because we're talking about a population of people for the majority of Africa to spend less than $10 a year on treating their total health care. So you can imagine that $3 for one dose, which is not, it's going to be out of reach, out of pocket for most of these people.
Wow. Comparatively,
what you can have is literally a handful of plants for pennies. It's in fact being shown to be effective and they're saving lives. So this is a real world example where we're using multiple chemicals in this tea of Sweet Annie versus one isolated constituent, artemisinin, to treat malaria.
Okay. Interesting. So then how would like a normal naturopath or herbalist go about then treating, like say in the United States, say like a sinus infection or something like that, compared to giving them like Zithromax or amoxicillin or something like that?
Well, first, I think in terms of chronic sinus infections, it's important to remember that when you culture these organisms causing this disorder, you'll find that about 96% of all the chronic sinus infections actually have a fungal component to them. So treating it with an antibiotic, which is targeted towards bacteria, first and foremost, is probably not a good idea. It may help in many cases, but I would say also in many cases, it's probably not doing us any good. What would you do? Would you treat it with an antibiotic? Would you treat it with an antifungal? If you take plants into consideration in terms, again, of their evolution, through, 300 million years of history, evolutionary history, what you'll see is that they've had to survive, and they've had to survive a hostile environment. This environment we're talking about is full of bacteria and fungi and herbivores and predators that want to eat them and basically in some way consume them and infect them. So the way that plants have handled that is that they have not just created one chemical that's effective against a particular organism. They create a broad array of chemicals that are potentially broad spectrum and therefore can affect a lot of the organisms in the environment and keep them at bay, if you will. So when it comes to medicinal plants, so first and foremost, every plant has got some sort of antimicrobial activity. If it didn't, it wouldn't have made it through hundreds of millions of years of evolution. So then you get into which plant do we want to use for a particular infection. And of course, that's going to depend on what kind of infection it is and where in the body it is and that sort of thing. But sinus infections, what I have found is that an herb called Yerba Monza, also known as Anamopsis californica, if you want to use the binomial scientific name, mixed with some echinacea, can actually be a very nice remedy. And sometimes thuja in there, or thuja, people will say, is also a nice addition to that.
Okay. And then it's like most everyone these days is looking for like something quick now, here we go. It's like when people are being treated with herbs, what is, here again, keeping along the lines of say like sinusitis or a bacterial infection, what do you let people know about it? Why you use like maybe use more than say like 5 days, like Zithromaxes.
Right. So great question. And that comes down to really a huge part of Western and even more so American culture, in that we're very accustomed to instant gratification. Look at the attention span of anybody under 30 these days. By the way, most of these electronic devices that can provide instant gratification for us can't be operated unless you're under 30 because you don't know how to use the damn thing. But, if you look at the fact that we're used to very quick results, you don't get quick results. For example, if you're treating, say that you really need about a week to 10 days to really get a hold of it, where antibiotic, usually it's going to be a little bit quicker than that. In the cases of, for example, of urinary tract infection, there are lots of herbs that actually are very effective for urinary tract infections, and they can be treated very quickly. And you want to treat it quickly because you don't want the urinary tract infection to migrate into the kidneys, which can be very dangerous. So it depends on exactly what herb we're dealing with and what condition we're actually dealing with, what kind of infection we're dealing with. But generally speaking, when I was practicing, what I would tell people when they come in, especially for chronic conditions, not necessarily infections, but more chronic conditions like arthritis or asthma or something like this, I would tell them, look, I need, and it depends on the condition, but I would usually say I need about 3 months to really work with you and make a difference. And if you can hang in there that long, I think we can really make a difference in your health. Whereas for most people, if you're getting pharmaceuticals, you would think, well, in a week it hasn't worked, so I'm going to stop taking it. Often herbs are a bit slower because they are gentler. With that, fortunately, comes, generally speaking, a better safety profile for herbal medicines.
Okay. Well, that's good. So then everyone really, we all need to ditch the, instant gratification, high speed lifestyle in order for us to be able to, get back to one where we're not so stressed and stuff and practice more patience. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, that is what I'm saying. And stress is a huge piece of American culture. But we shouldn't think that stress is just an issue of Western culture. I mean, if you look at so many areas of the world right now where we're having constant warfare, and being a person caught in that area, such as Syria or parts of Africa, you've got to think that they're as stressed, if not more stressed than we are, just trying to survive and get enough food to eat and being very concerned for their safety and their family's safety. So, yeah, stress does tend to be, usually when we think about it, we think of a Western culture because it's so fast-paced and we have so many demands on us. But it's also often, in a huge way, part of lower income or developing nations culture because of the lack of law and order and the inability to basically get your basic needs met.
Yeah, that's so true. So, you know, I mean, especially with like all those that are, like you said, in the war-torn areas, I mean, I'm sure they're experiencing things that, you know, here in the Western culture that we would never, you know, like experience or a lot of us hope not to experience. So, now going on track with, just at this point, like current research, what exactly is like the hot topic at this point as far as herbal research goes?
Oh, hot topics for herbal research. Well, I'm a big Echinacea fan. And if you look at the press tends to get a hold of the studies that show that Echinacea had a bad outcome in a study and really blow that up. But if you actually look at the meta-analysis where they look at a wide array of all studies and then compare them and get a result out of that, Echinacea does work. And I think one of the most fascinating things is one of the ways that Echinacea works is by hitting some of the cannabinoid receptors on immune cells. Now, when you hear that word on the radio, cannabinoid, you're going to be thinking about cannabis, which is going to make you think about marijuana. And let me just say first and foremost, Echinacea does not make you high. So if you're running to the store to get some Echinacea right now to change your consciousness, it's not going to work. However, having said that, immune cells also have a type of cannabinoid receptor on them, a type of protein that is involved in signaling. And it's very interesting that one of the ways that Echinacea has been found to work is to calm down immune response. And, of course, you have to keep in mind that when we get a cold or a flu, most of our symptoms are actually not from the organism, the viron that's in there, the virus, but are actually from our immune systems over-responding to the infection. And thus we get miserable and our nose hurts and our eyes get runny and we get achy. And most of this is actually our own immune system responding. So one of the things that Echinacea does is it calms that response down. So you don't have as much symptoms. Now that's one of the things it does. The other thing it does is it actually does have another aspect where it stimulates immune function so that you can fight the particle of the organism more effectively.
Okay, so then how exactly then if Echinacea almost sounds like one of these smart herbs. So how can it like help calm like the overreactivity of the immune system along with stimulating it as well?
Great question. And I'm sure that lots of listeners are asking the very same question. So a very astute question, Dr. Burns. So, and this comes to the complexity of plants in general, not only medicinal plants, but also food plants. Normally speaking, in pharmacology, we use one chemical at a time. And therefore, we get a very predictable effect. We get a unidirectional effect. It increases something or it decreases something or it inhibits something or it stimulates something. End of story. When you have a remedy that you take that has literally thousands of chemicals in it, what you get is something very, very different than a predictable unidirectional effect like a pharmaceutical would. Instead, what you get is this wide array of activity that some things may, for example, in the case of Echinacea, you may have some of those alkylamides, these constituents that give you the tingling when you taste Echinacea, may have a calming effect on the immune function. And other compounds, such as the caffeic acid derivatives, may directly be antiviral, which in fact is the case. And yet other compounds, such as some of the polysaccharides in Echinacea, actually stimulate immune function. So it's because there's not just one chemical in there. And so we can get a broad array of effect. And this can converge on an outcome, such as making us feel better, fighting the virus directly, stimulating the immune system to fight the virus, and calming the immune system down at the same time so that it's not overreacting.
Well, I mean, it's like, since like Echinacea and some of these other plants have like all these constituents in them and can do like so many different things at one time, why is it then that when did it come around that some scientists thought that only one constituent is better than having many constituents, i.e. the pharmaceuticals that are out there?
Well, this came from actually, if you will, 16th century physics. And interestingly, physics has always been the leading science in all the sciences. And in fact, many a physicist will hold their head high to say, yes, I'm a physicist, because they think they're at the top of the heap in terms of scientists. The reason that people think in this reductionist way is actually based on Descartes, the great philosopher, who was, by the way, also a physician. And his thought was that the universe is like a clock, and that by understanding a clock, which is a fairly simple thing, that you could take apart the pieces of a clock and find the broken piece or repair the broken piece. And so that was his model of the universe. It was like a clock. And so it was this reductionist model where all we had to do was take it apart and we could understand it. We could understand each piece. Well, it turns out that's not always true. And in fact, modern physics would tell you that's definitely not true, because it's not about the parts. It's about the relationship between the parts. And so every science back from about the 17th century on, every science tried to develop this reductionist model to be, if you will, quote unquote, scientific. Thus, medicine followed this model of let's find the one agent that fights whatever it is that we're dealing with in a patient. And in fact, Pasteur had a lot to do with that. Louis Pasteur, basically gave us the one lesion model, that there's one cause for a disease, and that there'll be one agent that will treat that disease, kind of thinking of the right antibiotic for the right microorganism. But it turns out that especially chronic diseases aren't simple at all. In fact, there's often many causes for disease. Thus, we need to think beyond just one simple remedy and think about something complex. And if you think about food, for instance, which was probably the original pharmacological agent that we all took in on, our ancestors took in. So our genome is about 3 to 7 million years old, depending on who you quote. And that genome has always been accustomed, until the last 100 years, has always been accustomed to being affected by multiple chemicals at once. Every time we swallowed a mouthful of food, often plants, we were getting thousands of chemicals all at once. And these would turn genes off, turn genes on. They would inhibit certain proteins. They would stimulate certain proteins. And thus, the original pharmacology, if you will, was very, very complex. And I think that if we really want to get into a place where we're having more efficacy in terms of chronic conditions, this is one of the ways that we need to be thinking in terms of more complex remedies. And in fact, it's already being done clinically. If you look at the newest cancer treatments, they're using multiple chemotherapeutic drugs. If you look at the newest AIDS treatments, they're using cocktails, multiple anti-HIV approaches to help things. If you look at some of the resistant diseases, such as tuberculosis in the inner city, they're using multiple antibiotics at once to hit the microbe that's causing this. So we really do need to be thinking about things in a more complex way. One of the reasons that we think about it in such a simplistic way is because until recently, we haven't had the technology to really think beyond a simplistic model. And another reason is that we have had this idea of Occam's razor of the universe, that it's always going to be the simplest explanation when we have weird results out of a scientific study. And in fact, Occam's razor, this whole idea, is not a scientific principle at all. It comes from a theologian, which most scientists would be mortified to know, that they're using a theological theory to try to explain scientific reason.
Interesting. So, well, I mean, now, do you find that with your travels, are people becoming more in the sense of looking at that we're needing to use multiple aspects instead of one aspect, or do you feel that still people are in the simplistic mode?
No, I think our science is getting more complex. The whole omics platform, genomics, proteomics, metabolomics, pharmacogenomics, nutrigenomics, the whole omics platform has created a much more complex model of human health and human disease. So I think we are getting more complex. And you're also starting to see pharmaceutical companies come around where they're combining more than one drug into one tablet or one pharmaceutical remedy. So okay. I think it is happening.
All right, that's good. So do you think that, do you feel that at this point in time in, let's say, like, I know that it's like in other cultures, like herbal medicine is like the first thing that they do and like antibiotics is the last thing. Do you see that switching in Western culture for that? Or do you feel that because it's been so long that everyone's been going to the, you know, to the pills first, that it's still going to take a while for the herbal aspect to come around?
Well, let's be clear in terms of what my book is. I don't want to get a bunch of phone calls. First, I am not opposed to pharmaceuticals. They have saved lives, and they're often very effective. They also kill about 100,000 people a year when properly prescribed and properly. So there's that to contend with. We have an issue. That is that our first line approach to treating any disease is to use something really strong. And often it works, and sometimes it doesn't, and it hurts people. So do I think that there's a way in our medical system to start with something more gently and use something more powerfully as a backup if the gentle approach doesn't work? Yeah, I think that's smart. I think it's going to save lives, and I think it's going to save money. So I think that is a potential future. If what you were saying is, yeah, 80% of the world's population still uses herbal medicine in some aspect of their primary care. If you look at it from that perspective, we could say that our medical system is developmentally delayed. Okay, here comes the letters and the phone calls. because we really have had a very closed mind to approaching or allowing the concept of something more gentle, such as an herbal medicine or a food approach, to treat serious disease. Now, I really do think we need to rethink that. Will it change? Is your question? I think the pharmaceutical companies will go kicking this. They have a huge, deep pockets. They own a lot of Congress people. I think they would do everything in their power to keep a remedy that's easily available to you and I from being the first line approach.
Okay. So interesting in not wanting to get on politics here. So from that aspect, but thank you for clarifying. So hopefully you won't be getting a lot of phone calls or emails from my multi-complex question that I ended up having. So so hopefully everyone will go easy on you. So with that one. So, but is there anything else that you see in the future? I mean, like you said, that you're a huge fan of echinacea. Are you seeing like any other, like from research that you've seen where they're coming up with new stuff with some of the more simple herbs like echinacea?
Well, I let me just mention omega-3s, essential fatty acid, omega-3. It seems to me we just get more and more and more great news and evidence about how effective omega-3s are. There's a new study out showing that that omega-3s actually have an effect on preventing tumor, breast cancer tumors. And when in these animal models where they're using them, when the animals do get the tumors, they're actually about 30% smaller. So between that, between the effects on brain development, between the effects on brain function, between the effects on depression and bipolar disorder, I really think omega-3s are up and coming. And in fact, the pharmaceutical companies have co-opted that, and they've created, and maybe you can recall, I don't remember the name of the drug they have, but they have created a slight variation on an omega-3 fatty acid molecule, and it's slated to be one of the biggest blockbuster drugs ever, because cardiovascular disease is such a huge issue, and so they're using it for cardiovascular disease.
Wow, thank goodness. Okay. Well, I know that Is there anything else you'd like to say, or before we end up going to break?
I guess I would just say to your listeners, live smartly, sleep, move, and eat well. And if you don't think you have time to do that, then you really don't have much of a chance of being very fulfilled in terms of your health potential.
So very smart, very good advice from Dr. Spellman. Thank you very much for joining us today. It's been a pleasure having you on.
Thank you, Dr. Burns. I really appreciate it.
All righty. All right. Well, we're going to go ahead and take a quick break, and we'll be back in a minute. Hey, it looks like we're back from our break, and it was nice to hear from Dr. Spellman and all the knowledge that he has. Just as a reminder, our charity is the USO, so if you can sponsor them, they so that they are not going to stop until everyone comes home. So, and I also want to give a thank you to all the men and women who serve in our military. It's great that we have you guys there, and thank you for help protecting us and for serving us. The rest of the time that we're going to have here is I've been having, you know, kind of talking about a little bit light with communication. I've been having an interesting time so far with the our new family addition here with the dog that we have, and finding out that as you know, the weeks have gone on, finding out more and more like the real personality that has come out from this beloved four-legged giant that I have in my house. And he's like this very good dog, but he has like certain habits that I guess like as people we don't find very good, like barking, jumping up, stuff like that. And so we're having, I'm having a trainer come over who I guess like, you know, quote, speaks dog for to train me and my family on how to basically work with, you know, this dog who is trying the best that he can to communicate with us because he only knows dog. And I'm like, I only know person. I'm like, I don't know dog. And sometimes with that, it makes me feel like, you know, like us as people, do we really and honestly, you know, like communicate with each other? Or do we just like halfway say what it is that we want to say because we're afraid that we're either going to hurt someone's feelings or we're guarding ourselves or we don't want to be vulnerable? And as I'm, you know, seeing here what I'm doing wrong as far as my communication right now with my dog, what exactly, you know, do we do with communication as people? And I remember, you know, for many times, like not wanting to hurt someone's feelings and being able to, you know, put myself out there. And even for me, you know, I've always been one, I've been like very guarded, you know, only say very little and try and get my point across, where it seems like that the true communication ends up coming in where you can be vulnerable and let people know exactly how you are and be able to speak, you know, what's coming from your heart. I guess to give an example of that is there was a person that I know who was, you know, I mean, saying, we were in a conversation and they were saying something and I just had to say, well, you know, then they came up with their conclusion on what I was trying to think. And I had to stop them and say, well, no, you know, that's not it. You know, this is actually what I was trying to say. And so I've noticed that when like we're all in busy mode and not being able to actually, you know, I mean, it's like we try to do like quick responses thinking that that's going to help out when actually this person misinterpreted what I was trying to say and I didn't, you know, give the background enough for that person to be able to correctly say what it is I was trying to say. And somehow that ends up, you know, we end up getting, you know, our perception is our reality, where we end up getting hurt feelings or you get a little confused. And sometimes because we don't understand like the whole gamut of the concept, it's like texting. Texting is one dimensional. It's not three dimensional, which is why for me as a doctor, I like to see my patients in office, and follow up phone calls are okay. But if there's something really going on, I like to see them in office because I like to see the whole three dimensional aspect of what's going on with facial expression, you know, like how they're holding themselves, body language, all that stuff. When we're texting in this day and age, there's that whole part is taken out. And so there could literally be thousands of meanings for like one little text that ends up coming in. And so that's why I feel like that as we get more and more into, you know, like the further technology advances, you know, the more it's like people are hiding behind like emails and texting, and a lot of it is being like misinterpreted. So, I mean, it's like I just found out 2 weeks ago that I guess if you're doing like all caps in text, it means that you're yelling, when it could just be possibly a mistake and the phone is, you know, on the fritz and the cap lock has stayed locked down. So there's all sorts of interpretations that's going on. If we don't, you know, make ourselves vulnerable to be able to explain, you know, it's like looking at someone, you know, on the level that we're at and being able to talk to them on that level, then that's kind of where communication gets skewed. So it's like there's always a right way and a wrong way to say something. And so whether it's needing to correct someone and, you know, there's a right way and a wrong way to say it. It's like one way is going to be, you know, demeaning and mean. The other way is that you're trying to help them out as well. And with expression and being able to, you know, let people know like where you're coming from. So that's why there's this very good article that I wrote that I was reading, and it comes from Peter Gray from Psychology Today. This is 2010 edition, where he's talking about unsolicited advice. And I love it here because he was giving an example between him and his wife and how he was just trying to help her out and suggesting, you know, like that maybe she shift to a different gear. And then how she got into says, well, you know, I've been driving for years, and, you know, how like a lot of us end up doing that. It's, you know, where he was trying to be helpful, she was seeing it as attack, I guess, on her individuality. And he ends up going, this Peter Gary ends up going on saying that for a lot of us, it's the timing of the advice that ends up coming in for it, and that, you know, to kind of like wait and have people ask, because most of us, you know, once we're like in a relationship, want to still be able to have a little bit, you know, of our identity, our freedom that we had before. And that if someone just kind of like comes in and nonchalantly, you know, gives an advice or opinion, that we automatically get defensive because we feel like that we have a fear, as he says here, of losing ourselves, or a threatening of losing ourselves. And so that's why we get upset with the other person. And I found that to be interesting, in that even that, with that loss of like self-identity, a lot of times we'll end up coming into like how we communicate with people and how we see them. And from the other side, how the other person was just trying to be helpful, but yet how if you someone tries to come in and say, you know, I mean, it's like, can you wait? You know, if someone tries to explain and say, you know, I'd like for you to wait until, you know, like I ask for an opinion instead of just giving it out, which happens in a lot of relationships. A lot of times that person who's trying to help will also be defensive as well, because then they feel like then that they're being rejected when they're just trying to help. So there's a lot of stuff that ends up going into communication. And I think this is why I'm like a total eternal student on like human behavior, because this is the one aspect that, you know, all of us try to come close to, but we also fall short as well, which is why I think we got a lot of linguists out there, body language experts and stuff like that, to try and help all of us communicate. And so the easiest people that we can actually like work with and be with are like kids, because they're so open to ideas and stuff, and they will let you know if they like it and if they don't. Whereas adults, somehow we end up putting that filter in, you know, with saying that we just kind of like, you know, take it and bury it and don't really get out our feelings. that we used to have before. So this is something that I think that, you know, is lifelong, that somehow as adults we ended up losing, is that aspect of being free to be able to, you know, say things, because things have been so political in our social scenes with, you know, the people who we love. And it's somehow as we grow up that it's end up, you know, that pureness that we've had and the innocence of being able to address someone and then have everything be okay afterwards, somehow ends up getting lost through that aspect. So as I am learning from, I feel like that I am just relearning, like, all over again from this, you know, from the dog that we have in our house, and just how nerves, you know, when someone's nervous, and like how that there's this difference in the reaction compared to when someone's like totally comfortable with themselves and are able to be themselves, and how, you know, like we accept it. And I absolutely love and adore this dog that we have. He is just absolutely magnificent, a very patient dog as well. You know, a lot of energy, a lot of positive energy coming from it. And he is just trying to be himself because that's been embedded in him. So I am like waiting and for this time for me to be able to learn this language that I didn't have before, and being able for both of us, both the dog and myself, to communicate with each other where we can both understand one another, instead of me saying one thing and then my dog thinking, oh, well, she's joining in with me, so I'm just going to do it more. So it's so it's just kind of interesting seeing the, you know, communication there between us and, you know, between animals and humans, and also between like humans and humans. So, you know, as we go along, we'll also get some other people on here who are, you know, going to be talking about like different ways of communication and how with improvement and stuff like that. So, and with the future broadcasts, what we're going to do is actually, I'm going to get into a lot of the medical aspect and where stress comes from and how this affects the body, you know, like with our own internal communications that we have, and being able to help out with that. So, because as a doctor, what I do as a naturopath is I try to look at the whole person, not just the symptoms. And as Dr. Spellman was explaining before, you know, one plant has many components to it, to where it can do many different things at one time, where a pharmaceutical can only do like one thing, and that's what it is ability to do. So for the body and for us as individuals, be able to tap into our own communication, and for our body to be able to do what it needs to do on a basis, is a lot of times you have to look into all the aspects that are going into that person and what's creating what, instead of just like looking at one thing at a time. Because just as plants are very complex, people are very complex as well on the inside. I mean, or else I wouldn't have to have spent, you know, 4 years in undergrad, 4 years in graduate school trying to you know, understand the workings of the human body. And then we have those out there who understand like the workings of the mind, the specialists of the psychologist, the therapist, the psychiatrist. So, and this is going to be fun as we end up building this, this program on what exactly is, you know, for how we're going to deal with like every aspect that comes out. So I appreciate everyone for joining us, and we're going to clock out, and we'll see everyone next time.